This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today, I visit with Dolly M. Waddell to talk about a book she has written titled Little Old Woman with a Wart on Her Nose. That's a provocative title, and I welcome Miss Dolly. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. You are in North Carolina, and it must be a beautiful day today. You sound cheerful, and this sounds like a book that has an interesting story behind the story. Tell me about it. How did this get written, and why?
Well, it came all in one time. I was living in Japan, and I taught children off and on, even in Japan, and it just seemed right to write it. But growing up, since it's a book on making fun of other people and type of a bullying, I was made fun of, and I guess that's still stuck in my mind, even after I'd grown up and was living in a different country.
Living in a different country, and the idea came, well, I should put this into writing. How did you, put it into writing? Did you write it down at the time, or did you just have the idea in your mind and decide to produce it later in life?
I wrote it down immediately and then decided to publish it later.
And didn't even lose the written down notes on your story?
No, sir.
That's interesting. I probably would have lost it. It would be lost somewhere in the debris field that is part of my moving and shifting locations. You've also included in there a little poem that says this: Here comes the little old woman with a wart on her nose. A wart on her nose, a wart on her nose. Here comes the little old woman with a wart on her nose, and we can see it wherever she goes. Was that a song or was that a chant?
It's a chant. I was very poor. I considered then. Right now, I don't consider that as poor as I thought back as a child. But I read every book that I could get my hands on in the schoolroom, mm-hmm. And that's how I spent my time. And my recreation was doing a lot of reading. And to me, reading is one of the most educational things a child can do. And it would take me places. I had dreams of going to the places that I read about. And I did get to go to one of those places. Some of my favorite books were the Bobbsey Twins. And they had books on the Bobbsey Twins in Japan, China, Holland, all those different countries. And that was a dream of mine, to go to one of those countries, never ever really realizing that I'd get there. But I did.
Those were popular. That was a popular series. I'm wondering if those books are still available in print.
I don't know.
Were there other books that you read that you remember from the library at the school?
Right now, I can't remember. If I had that question before, I probably could remember. But our teachers used to read to us. She would start with one book, and she would read so many chapters a day, and then we would really be anxious to hear the others, as she would do that every day. And it was really interesting just to see what was going to happen in that book.
And later in life, as your marriage progressed and so on, you went back to school, obtained a degree, and also became an educator.
Yes, sir. I had always wanted to go back and get my education. And after our children left home, I got my GED in 1975 because I had not, I'd only had an eighth grade education. And I passed my GED with enough points to go to college. And I attended college in 1978 to 1981. And I made almost a B average. I like just one little point making a B average in college. And then after that, I graduated on January the or December the 31st, and I was hired in January to be a substitute teacher in the county schools in West Virginia, in the Braxton County Schools in Sutton, West Virginia. And I taught there until an accident. I fell down the school stairs, and that I had an injury that, you know, I couldn't get back into the teaching. But I taught for about 4 years in the schools. And then I taught Sunday school for 35 years to children. And that was really the highlight of my life, was being able to teach Sunday school. And I've watched many of them grow up. And then I was teaching their children before we left West Virginia and moved to North Carolina.
In addition to your story, your book, your personal life is certainly one that should be congratulated and celebrated. Thank you for what you've done for education and for others. You also have been, I will mention this for the listeners, married to the same gentleman for over 60 years. That's a great accomplishment.
Yes, 64 in October.
Amazing. And your book that you've written, A Little Old Woman with a Wart on Her Nose, who do you think is going to benefit from reading this book?
I think that children who have been made fun of and need an incentive to realize that it's just words and that they can overcome being made fun of. It's difficult today, I know. They've got a lot more things to deal with than I had to deal with. But you still can overcome that if they will think about themselves and feel more good about themselves. It took me a good while to feel good about myself. The things that was done to me and the fun that was made of me, and even one teacher that really hurt my feelings. It took me till I became a Christian to understand that God gave me the ability to understand that I am a person and He loves me as well as He loves everybody. I was an introvert, and I became a person that just wanted to tell everybody about what was going on in my life. And it just made me a different person when I became a Christian. And also, this can help children to feel that way about themselves. But they still should know that they're special. A child should be taught that he is special, or she.
Very important lesson, life lesson. And in our society, bullying has become a difficult task for some children to address. This also could be a teaching element for maybe educators and parents.
Yeah, I think so. I even think this is good for adults, because I see a lot of people disrespecting. People just don't disrespect each other today.
That's true. That's true. And one of your characters, which one of the characters do you think is the most interesting in the book, in addition to the little lady that's sitting on the porch doing her knitting?
Tiny man.
Tell me about
him. The little man. You know, people will, or children will look, I've looked, and children will listen to a story that's not real, a fictional story, then sometimes more than they will listen to what, like mom says, get out of here, go do that. You got to do this, you got to do that. Well, sometimes if they read about, just read on their own and think for themselves, that this type of a character can help them think. It may not be real to other people, but it can kind of be real to them.
Absolutely. Are there other books that you have seen that have been written that deal with bullying on the same level that your book deals with bullying?
Not lately, I haven't.
What is the underlying message that you want to convey to the reader?
Is to know that everybody is a special in their own way, that each one individual has a different way of thinking, and that sometimes we judge them, but instead of looking at them and becoming to know them as a person, it's really beginning, you know, to know people instead of just looking at the outer part, but to know that person on the inner part of them.
Very important message. The name of the town, when the story begins, is what?
Oh, Mean.
And it becomes, what does it become?
happy.
Mean and happy. Nice contrast. And there's a special story that weaves throughout this short read, 16 pages, that will tell you why it changes from the town of mean to happy. So that's an enticement for our listeners to buy your book and read the complete story. How would you introduce your book to someone that doesn't know about you or your history?
I guess I would just tell them that it's a children's book, mainly on making fun of people and bullying, and that how people can overcome that, and not only children but even adults would be able to get a lesson out of it.
And were there some challenges in getting this book published?
Oh, working with the computer and getting it to the publisher with the computer.
And what about your illustrator? How did you locate your illustrator?
He was one of my art professors in college. And he today is retired. He's older. He was older than my husband and I anyway. My husband attended with me. But they keep in touch with me. And I do share everything with him and his wife. We became close friends with our college professor.
The illustrations are very well done and certainly fit the setting beautifully.
I'll pass that on to him.
Good. You can tell him that I thought it was great. What he's done is excellent.
Okay.
The title of this book is Little Old Woman with a Wart on Her Nose, and her author is Dolly M. Waddell. Dolly, where do we get copies of your book?
You can get them at Westbow Press and Amazon, and it was on Barnes & Noble.
Very good.
And then you can even buy them from me. My address may be in there, but I would prefer that you go to Westbow Press and buy them.
Excellent. They can do a search online for Dolly M. Waddell and also find out if there's something else on the horizon. Are you thinking about writing maybe a follow-up book?
Well, I've been thinking about doing a book on a little dog that we got at the pound and rescued him from being euthanized.
Yes.
And we're thinking about that. Plus, I do a lot of photography, and I'm thinking of doing a book on the photography of the backyard.
Fabulous. Well, we would love an opportunity to talk to you about that if that ever gets published. Thank you for joining me today.
Yes, sir, and thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath, those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage, connectwithjulianainmedia.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune into TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Joy of Fellowship, Walking with God. And the author, Edward J. Jones, and Edward joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Edward.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us, and you really want to help us understand fellowship. That's a key, not only a word, but it is a kind of a way of life, wouldn't you say?
Yes. It is a way of life because, fellowship requires two sides. And whether it be our walking with a friend or our walking with God, there's still the fellowship is the interplay of those two. And that's really where fellowship and walking with God occur, is in that fellowship. And I've spent a lot of time studying that, and academically I am prepared for that, and that's why I would like to spend time talking about it, because most people don't understand that. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Well, that's fine, and we certainly want to spend most of our time discussing that with you. But first of all, before we do that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what led to the publishing of your book?
All right. Yeah, good. I'm a senior citizen. I'm almost 80 years old. And, of course, as the rest of us, we've accumulated many experiences. And in looking back, I can see that God led me in a very clear direction and gave me experiences and academic training in two areas. And they're the two areas that would be involved in our exploring or studying fellowship. And one is the natural man, us, and the other side is God. And initially I was a psychology, sociology major, and I was a licensed therapist, secular therapist. And then when I became a Christian, I went back to school and became a prison chaplain. So my life then became a biblical life. And So I think that in terms of that and some work relationships, the two sides that we would study in a relationship with man, I was given the academic preparation for. And these are two fields that don't naturally go together. They tend to see life differently. But I think it's very important, and God very purposefully gave me training in these fields. So now I have, it sounds funny to say, but I have 6 degrees, but it's not that weird because I had two careers, and both careers required academic preparation. So I think that's what I really like to talk about, because God, when he created us, with not only the physical side. Usually we think about our physical side when we think of God's creation. But he also created us with the attributes and the academic and the intellectual and emotional components, the invisible parts of us. And it's those invisible parts of us that are basically us in terms of a relationship with someone, and not the physical side. So I really think that there was a lot of preparation in that, and really God did that very much on purpose. When we talk about, well, I don't know. I'm going to let you
go ahead.
Because I'm kind of getting carried away.
No, not at all. You're making a lot of sense. But let me ask this question, though. Modern man, often we think of modern man, he is so, has so much. Look at all the resources we have today and the technology and the way we live. And yet you make this statement about him cheating himself, modern man. Now, what do you mean by that?
Because we get so involved in the circumstantial things of life. You see, people that are really running between things, they're running to do things, and they're thinking. So much of our thinking is based on what we see on television now. You know, there's very few people read anymore. I'm coming to that. I'm finding that with this book, that a lot of the people I thought would be reading it are, ask, well, gee, is it coming out in... in a video or anything, you know, because they're just not geared to reading anymore. And I think that there's been a change, and it was a big change when I had kids. I see my grandkids, and they all, you know, they come to visit me, and they're very happy to see me, but then they sit, and they have these little electronic things in their hands, and they're really living in a different world. And I think it's just a question of getting back to the Bible and getting back to praying and meditating, because that's where we, when we're talking about fellowship, it's a one-sided fellowship unless we let God do his part. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, the pace of life, and also the electronics that people have in their lives these days. Just isn't it grounded the way that it doesn't allow for that fellowship and the back and forth with God that prayer and meditation do.
The meeting between Nicodemus and Christ really is very extremely meaningful to you. Why did you cover that meeting so extensively in your book?
Well, there are several reasons. It's chapter 2 in the book. And it's John, the third chapter of John, and it's very meaningful, I think, to every Christian, because there's some very important things included in that. But why I use so many quotes is that I wanted anyone who feels problem with the concept of being born again. You know, Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and life. No one shall enter the kingdom of heaven except through me. And then he goes on to explain that that requires a born-again experience. Nowadays it seems to be right up there with the conflict over creation and evolution in terms of, you know, what that means. But I think it's so very important, because that is, you know, it's God's heaven, and he can set any criteria he wants for people coming in. And if this is his criteria, but why I include that, and I want everybody to read it, is so they can't argue with me. I quote Jesus when he's explaining what the born again experience is. And if they want to fight, they'll have to fight with God, because I'm not going to get pinned down on that one. So that's really why it's so meaningful to me. It's like the key to the kingdom, so to speak.
So your title, The Joy of Fellowship, Walking with God. Now, help us understand your view of walking with God.
Well, yes. I think that God, I really believe that God, when he wants to teach us something, uses what's familiar to us, and uses basically what's very easy for us. And there's several things that are true of our walking with friends. We have, this is something we very commonly know. And this is something, too, that a lot of people have given me feedback on the book, that they understand, or they feel that they can be closer to God by looking at it in terms of the way they would relate to a friend. Very often people, when they think of God, they think of praying, and that's their communication to God. They don't leave themselves open to the other, to a real relationship, where the Abba Father relationship, which is the loving Father, the Father you can get up on his lap and tell him your troubles. That's the other side of that. That's as biblical as there's a distant God, or the judging God. But there's a few things that, about walking with a friend, that are very common to a relationship with God. One of the things is, two people are usually alone, and they can be intimate with each other in a conversation. They're traveling at the same speed. These are just some I've come up with, but I'm sure people can come up with more. They agree on a destination. And that's true of God and man in fellowship. There's usually a bonding, or at least a familiarity. There is usually a fondness for each other. They are aware of the presence of each other. Now, that's a big one, because we can walk with God, and I think that's what I kind of, Lord led me to believe in Phoenix, that as long as we're in each other's presence, we're walking with God. We don't set aside a time for prayer or something. We're aware of each other's presence all the time. We're aware of God's presence all the time. And, of course, to sum that up is the famous verse in Amos, that two men cannot walk together unless they be in agreement. And a lot of that, when you're talking about a friend, is negotiation over various issues. And that's why you're able to bond like that. The same thing is kind of true with God. You know, we can share. God has his way. You know, God does his teaching. We have the scriptures. And we have the We have the things I'm just talking about now. God does have various ways that he teaches us and brings us along. And a lot of them are very with things that are very common to us, and so and then we share back with to the Abba Father, the familial Father, and so that we really can capture the same kind of relationship. That this is a great thing about us taking on this book. My view of our fellowship with my relationship to God has totally changed. And people have told me, I have a next-door neighbor who told me exactly the same thing, that he's over 80 and he's been an elder in his church all his life, and he said he always thought of God as distant and far away and powerful and everything. I'm not taking any of that away from God. But then he said, you know, while I was reading some of the book, I kind of could picture Jesus sitting on the sofa with me. And that's what the book has done for me, is that there's a very human or a connection, a relationship connection with between us and God if we nurture that and use it.
Now, your walk with God has given you some incredible experiences. You were a prison chaplain, but that still weighs upon you.
I think it probably always will. We have 2.5 million prisoners in our prisons, and we set up a committee to try to, because in Matthew 25, Jesus says, "Did you feed me when I was hungry? Did you clothe me when I was naked? Did you visit me in prison? And what you do for the least of these, you also do for me." I'm sure you're all familiar with that verse. Well, you know, the people aren't. They're rotting in prison, psychologically, spiritually. And, you know, being there, I was able to bring some fellowship to them and bring some joy to them. We could have a laugh once in a while. But we have a committee that that writes prison. We use the mails to do this because, you know, we can't really visit them all, but we can visit them through the mails. And there'll be a burden I'll always have. I picture people that I knew in prison, and it kind of deteriorating. They're just kind of losing it.
And you've been able to raise donations to get your book to the prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've gotten some very incredible feedback. I mean, it chokes me up almost to think that people are that needy for something that I've done. But that's very much the case, and it's been the whole thing has just been a tremendous blessing to me.
Now, has your book turned into a weekly blog?
It started out that way, but then in terms of some questions and things, we've gotten off the subject quite a bit. We'd get into a big fight over Santa Claus at Christmas time and things, but it's been fun. It's been enjoyable, and the guys that have been fighting with me about it, not fighting about it, but fellowshipping with me about it. You know, we've had a lot of fun with it. And I think it's been a blessing because we can share our faith.
Now, after we're born again, the very importance of that, obviously you've already pointed that out through Christ's teachings. Can we sin after we're born again? And then, of course, what happens if we do?
Well, we become children of God. Same thing that happens when we're born again, that our sins are covered by the blood of Jesus Christ. You remember the verse in Hebrews where God said, "Come boldly into my throne room," and it's because he sees us covered with the blood of Jesus Christ that we can be in his presence. In the Old Testament, you couldn't be in God's presence. You remember they had in the tabernacle, there was a separation, and mm-hmm. The chief priest once a year could go in and minister and do sacrifices and things, but the people couldn't. Remember when Christ died on the cross, the curtain was ripped, supernaturally ripped. Nobody ripped it. But that was symbolic of the fact now we have access to God because of the blood of Jesus Christ. So that, yes, we do sin. We will be expected to sin. We're encouraged many times in the Bible, do not sin. But we don't lose our fellowship. Once, you know, there's a verse that Jesus says, nothing can pluck you out of my hand. And once we are born-again children of God, that's sealed. And one of the ministries of the Holy Spirit, of course, is sealing us into that relationship.
We've been listening to Edward J. Jones, his book, The Joy of Fellowship, Walking with God. Edward, tell us how we can get your book.
It's at all the major distributors. I prefer you use Westbo because my publisher, but that looks good for me if you do. But it's on the internet. It's we have a website. My website is www.preacherbook, all small letters, PreacherBook.com, and they'll set it right up for you.
Well, thank you so much, Edward, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much for visiting.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Westbo Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book we're reviewing today is certainly an interesting book. Provocative title, and more provocative is the artwork on the interior. One that I might say I enjoyed, thought it was very well done. The title of the book is My Death, A Personal Guidebook by Jeremy Kagan. Professor Kagan joins me today from California. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to be, period.
Yes. Well, apparently, if you had a death experience and a personal guidebook related to that, tell me the background. What inspired you to put this 126-page biographical sketchbook together?
It was because it actually happened to me. I certainly wouldn't have preconceived it, certainly didn't intend it to happen when it happened, and it took me 20 years to figure out actually how to put it in a form that other people could experience it. But I suspect the inspiration was this. Until this time, I had no idea sort of what death meant. I was fortunate enough not to be surrounded by it like some of my companions and contemporaries had been. I lost very few people in my life and was not, as far as I could understand, close to it. So it was something as far away from me as, possibly you on the other end of the phone or Mars or something. It just didn't have any real relationship to me. And then I had this experience. The experience was a total experience in which I did, at least from every way I can describe it, die.
Mm.
And then I returned from this death with an amazing set of encounters, and more importantly, a conclusion that I didn't have beforehand. And that, I felt, was probably the most profound thing I had ever experienced and the most valuable thing I could communicate to anyone else. So if there's one reason I was put here, maybe it was, in fact, to retell this experience and its conclusion to as many people as I can, so that I and the rest of us who get this awareness to know that death is not to be feared. So that's really the inspiration of this piece.
Tell me about the actual...
Continues live inspiration for me. Keep going, yeah.
I'm sorry. Tell me about the near-death experience itself. You mentioned a Native American sweat lodge. Was that involved in the process that you refer to as your near-death experience?
Yeah, I want to do two things. I want to sort of repeat what I say the purpose of the piece is, which is to communicate the concept that death is not the end of our consciousness. And the things that we fear about death are themselves illusions. That's what I learned from the experience. Now, the specific part of the experience has two things to it. One of the things I want to talk about is, those of you who are hearing this, you may have heard of the expression near-death experience, or NDE. And by the way, I had never heard of this experience until I had mine. The concept itself is a sort of strange one in the sense that the idea is that in various capacities, some of them under total sort of Western medical observations and others on far more scientific investigations, people
right.
encounter the possibilities and the realities in their life where they seem to be dead, either from the sort of medical definition of death or from an experience of their own sort of awareness and understanding that they go through a process, and this process has been recorded for millennium, but certainly recorded recently in the last, I'd say, 50 years. Lots of times, if you go online, you can look up various near-death experience websites and find out what they're like, and there are lots of common things that happen through these experiences, and I'd say it happened to me as well, and many of the common ones, and there's things that happened to me that were totally exceptional, unlike any of the other experiences that I've read about and witnessed. But one of the things that's interesting, that I thought about this literally 2 days ago, it's too late to change the title, or at least the word near death in the book or memoir, which I think I would say it's, I think I look at this more as a illuminated manuscripts, those of you who've ever seen those kind of things from the Middle Ages, because there's 150 drawings in this piece that I made, or paintings that I made, as well as the text itself. But I think it's really more through death. And the idea is that every one of us, in fact, either has already gone through, if you believe in reincarnation, or if you don't believe in reincarnation, you are going to go through, because you certainly aren't going to have this happen, death. So the issue is that death is not an end. And I think for many of us, we think of it as an end. Or we think of it, if we've grown up in a religious tradition, that death is an end, and then there's going to be these alternatives that the religious traditions have presented us. An alternative of heaven, or, and I use the word properly, God forbid, if you believe in God, an alternative of hell.
Right.
What's fascinating from my experience, and by the way, this is shared by other people who have their experiences in this near-death or through-death experience, is that particularly the issue of hell, that itself is a total illusion. There, at least from my specific personal experience, is no real hell. I did go to a hell in my experience, but when I realized that the entire thing was like a movie being played, and, you know, when we go to the movies, I make movies, that's my business, an art form, you know, we believe what we're seeing. We're totally engrossed in it. We suspend our disbelief, as the phrase goes, and then when the movie's over, we're back into our own reality. Well, in terms of my experience of my own personal going to hell after my death, that was there, and it was powerful, and it was overwhelmingly negative until I realized that, in fact, all it was an imagined space and experience. Because one of the things that's quite true about at least my experience, and it seems to be everybody else's experience who goes through these near-death or through-death experiences, is that one of the first things you lose is your capacity to have any of your senses work. So you can't see anymore, you can't hear anymore, you can't certainly move, you can't feel anything or be touched. All of those senses go. As with anybody who dies, you lose all of those. But the thing that I didn't lose, and the thing I think that no one loses, is your consciousness.
Right.
Not necessarily your thoughts. They, too, are with you for a while, but they also then disappear like clouds in the sky. But the sky never disappears, meaning your consciousness, your awareness of what is, that is impossible to disappear, and that was one of the sort of revelations and of this entire experience. And in a way, it's incredibly freeing, because if you come from the place that consciousness itself has no time in it, it just is. This is the experience that we have. In fact, we can even have, those people who work at this, you can even have that experience while you're still in your incarnation of a body.
Oh, that would be probably helpful. You mentioned a sweat lodge.
I know what a sweat lodge is.
Tell about that.
Also something, sweat lodges are dark places that are incredibly hot in which a group of people gather, usually under a very ceremonial setup, in order to literally sort of, and I'll use this word, purify, sort of in a way physically because you sweat a lot, but also emotionally and psychologically and spiritually, if that word means something to you, cleanse yourself. It's a tradition that covers cultures all around the world. It's a tradition that also goes back thousands of years. In a way, the metaphor is like sort of climbing back into a sort of a womb-like space because it's very, very dark. And then an elemental space because rocks that are usually volcanic rocks are heated incredibly hot. And what's fascinating, by the way, is when in the darkness, in black darkness, volcanic rocks still have little sparkles like stars. So in a way, space is both very confined and strangely suggesting the whole cosmos and universe. And in this space, usually there are certain rituals that go on. You don't take any drugs to go into this. This is very clean. This is, as I said, it's very orderly. I was lucky enough to have a number of these experiences because of some younger friends who sort of gave me the opportunity to do this. This was led by the Lakota. We call them the Sioux, but the Lakota is their name. And this was a very, again, respected and very ordered ritual. And I'd done a number of them before. In fact, a couple of them before, I'd actually, at the end of the heat, and I don't like the heat, and I sweat way, way too much, and I feel very uncomfortable. And if there are a lot of people, you know, like the bumping into people, although you're sitting down, but something, you know, you're maybe rubbed up, you know, by somebody's elbow or knee or something like that, because people move around as it's uncomfortable in that heat.
Let me ask you a question about that heat and also the uniform du jour. Is it as in your sketchbook? Is it as I anticipate? It's too warm for clothing, hence the government issue birthday suit.
Well, you know, it's suggested in certain of these that you enter this place as naked as you came into the world.
Right.
Because in a way you are stripping away all of the world's coverings to get back to being really honest about who you are and truly are. And so therefore, it is encouraged to go in naked. Some people do, some people don't, depending on your own embarrassment. But I've done this a number of times. It's dark enough that you can't really see anybody before you go in because these things are at night. So all embarrassment was a little bit shaded. I was quite used to doing it, and that, as most of the people in this particular sweat that I went to, used to being naked inside. But as I said, it's black, so you're not looking at anybody.
Right.
And there are four stages to this ritual. One is what's called the you pray for everybody. You pray for yourself first, but then you pray for people you know. Then there's a very difficult challenge, the third quarter, where you state what you're willing to give up. Because oftentimes we're possessed by stuff. And not so much I'm willing to give up, oh, my, you know, fancy watch or something, but literally the possession of, oh, I'm driven by wanting to be a giant success at whatever I'm doing, and it's such a I'm so owned by that I never take time to even be with friends or communicate because I'm so driven. I'm willing to give up that.
Mm-hmm.
See, very, very difficult phase for most people. This sort of this thing where you literally say out loud what you're willing to let go of, and then the fourth is a silent phase, oftentimes accompanied by music from a particular culture, in this case Lakota culture, And sometimes you have visions because you've, in the heat, and your mind has sort of been freed and washed away from a lot of the sort of monkey business that your mind is mostly occupied with during the other times. And sometimes you sort of get messages or see things. In my particular case, when I did this before this through-death experience, I didn't have any dreams. This was not a particularly powerful sweat. But it was a sweat which was the day before my birthday, and it was a very cold where I did this, so that I'd been, if you will, naked outside, gone inside in the heat, and it lasts for, I don't know, about an hour, I think, maybe a little longer, and then come outside back into the cold from this very, very intense heat. And I literally lost my balance, fell to the ground, and figured, oh, well, I must be having some kind of hypothermia, but a minor issue about hypothermia. Mm-hmm. I later learned that hypothermia kills people. But I fell to the ground and sort of realized I couldn't quite move, but I figured I would be within a few seconds. I just had to readjust to the change in the temperatures. But the few seconds became more than a few seconds, and instead of gaining control of my body, I noticed I was, in fact, totally losing control of my body. I could not move. And soon, not only could I not move, but I couldn't hear, and I couldn't see, and my breath turned into gravel. And that was the beginning of the realization that I was in big trouble. And I figured, well, they'll call the paramedics when they notice, because most people are going back to around a fire area, I assume, and it left me be there. And I had been at another sweat once when someone was having a very deep emotional problem and also had sort of gone on the ground, but I guess in his case, if he had chosen to. And I remember the leader saying, let him alone. He needs to be where he is, you know, just let him go through what he's going to go through. And I even had the leader, this was just happening, come over to me, and I could vaguely hear him saying something like, let go. And I figure he was just, from his perspective, seeing that I was fine, whereas from my perspective, I realized he'll know pretty soon and the paramedics will be here. Things move much quicker than the paramedic possibility of arrival, since we were way on a mountain. And soon, within seconds of losing all these capacities, I don't know if it's seconds is the right word, but losing the capacities, losing all my sense experiences, I began to realize I was not going to be on set the next day directing a motion picture, which was my job, so obviously my job was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't communicate, so I wouldn't be able to. In fact, I figured the paramedics would take me to some place, and since I couldn't see and couldn't hear and couldn't move, those people who I love, my wife, my child, they wouldn't be able to sort of communicate to me, and I certainly couldn't communicate to them, so that was gone. And then I realized that it wasn't just that that was going, I was going, that I, in fact, was dying. And when I had that realization, I was in absolute terror. But since I couldn't move, there was nothing I could do. But I did sense that there was something I could resist, that somehow an internal struggle, even though I couldn't actually do anything, but somehow sort of my consciousness at the time, if I could hold on like holding your breath for as long as you can, if I could sort of do that on a molecular level, maybe I would still be able to avoid dying. And I tried to get all my molecules to stay in place, but of course it was impossible. And inevitably, you have to let your breath go out when you hold it for as long as you can, and so I had to let myself, in essence, go out. And that was my dying, and there was a quick, strange realization that it was perfectly blissful. It was ecstatically calm, serene, gentle, peaceful, and so uncomplicatedly easy that I was in a ecstatic moment of surrender of everything. It was perfect, and I had no thoughts until I asked myself, well, wow, this is wonderful, perfect. What happens next? And the minute I had a thought, which was that question, all kinds of things began to emerge, including my wondering whether, you know, what if I, then what if there were, although I grew up being taught that, in fact, heaven and hell were not the horrors that some religions put out there, But what if they were? I'd thought about it, certainly read about it, and sure enough, the place that I went to at that moment was my own version of hell. And you'll have to read the memoir to get the details on that, because some of it I don't think is good for just radio and voice.
Yes.
But when I also got that, in fact, what this was, it was in fact merely my thought. I had created it. It wasn't real. My senses weren't real. They were gone. It totally dissolved. It was just imagined. Hell is just your imagination, but you believe in it. Now, when you go through the through-death experience, you may very well, particularly if you've grown up with guilt, and as most of us have, or fears, as most of us have, then the possibility is you'll go there. And those of you who are read sort of a classic literature are going to be familiar that, you know, many of the great stories of our times, or particularly in the Western stories, well, I suspect it's probably true in the East, but sort of the classics like the Odyssey and certainly Aeneid and Dante's in the story of the Inferno and Paradiso. And, you know, these characters, these great pieces of literature, as they go through their journeys, oftentimes go through a hell, but they get out of that hell. So in a way, it's part of our process. We have to sort of get rid of our negativity, which oftentimes we've put on ourselves or we've bought from other people who've told us this is the way things are and believed it. We need to wash that away, and first by experiencing and then recognize that, in fact, the experience is merely imagination. Then began this journey that was totally spectacular, many ways similar to other people's journeys in terms of their near-death experiences, in which I was like on the, this is a specific reference, those people who used to go to Disneyland years ago, there used to be the thing called the E-Ride, which was the best rides in Disneyland. Well, this was the E-Ride quadrupled beyond by a trillion, in which I was being taken through various spaces that did have visual natures to them, not too much oral, which is an interesting thing for me, but I'm a very visual person, and I suspect that part of the journeys that people take are reflections of, to some degree, who they are, even though the who they are is beginning to be washed away, so that our particular egotistical histories start to disappear, and all we're doing, or all I was doing, was it being aware of what was happening, but not controlling what was happening, or even commenting on what was happening. It was awesome, in the true sense of awesome, being, I was filled with the awe and wonder of what was and what is. In my case, there was a time, one part of the passages was through this sort of tunnel space, which is often talked about in near-death experience, but for me, there were sort of beings, but beings that were moving very, very slowly, though I was moving faster than they were. And they may have been ancestors of mine who were sort of all to the left and right. They may have actually been the spirits of people who were living from the time that I had been living, who were also there. They were more sort of observers. Advice was not coming. There was just sort of an awareness of their presence.
Well, it's a fascinating tale that you're telling. I want to sidestep, if you don't mind. I've only got a couple, 3 minutes left, but I did notice in your book a mention of an automobile that I had an affection for as a young lad growing up in Canada, the Avante. What is the significance of that particular vehicle? And I understand you still own one of those treasured cars.
Yes, I do. The Avante was a wonderful car designed in the 1963-64 by Raymond Loewy, a great industrial designer. The Avante was very, very far ahead of its time, a beautiful, slick car. I happened to fall in love with this car company called the Studebakers that also has a wonderful history. But I think the thing about the Avante is Avante itself means to sort of move on, or I think if I'm correctly, I may be wrong about the literal translation of the Italian, but the idea of movement and going somewhere, it's sort of appropriate because this is the car that I would drive all the time where I live and drive to my work as a director and drive through the town. And I drove up on this mountain in Malibu to this sweat lodge in this Avanti. And why I just thought about it just now, this car, I've stopped driving and replaced it with a hybrid car to be a little bit more responsible to the environment around us. But the Avanti is still in my driveway. And here's a fascinating thing for me, because when you brought it up, and it is, and those of you who look it up online, you'll see how what a stylish, sleek car it is. The issue is being able to let go of things. Now, I don't drive the Avanti anymore, but it's in my driveway. So I'm still holding on to stuff because I like to pass by it. It's now almost become a place for a gardening tool, getting surrounded by a various green that has been around the driveway.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that I think is a powerful thing about this whole experience is, as we all know, you can't hold on to anything. And oftentimes we are owned by things that we desire, the things that we acquire, sometimes things that we loathe and want to make sure don't happen to us. And in a way, this whole business of both desiring something and holding on to it limits us from the greater realization that we are such a larger being than what we have. And to remind ourselves by any means, and I hope people don't have to go through the fears that I went through in terms of my through-death, near-death experience, but to remind ourselves that we are more than the stuff we have. We're even more than the wanting of that stuff. We are the capacity of awareness of even that wanting. And that awareness doesn't want. That awareness just is. And for us to know that isness is truly who we are, and to find ways to remind ourselves during the day, that's really a goal, so that we don't end up holding on to things that really limit who we are. But it's a difficult struggle. And
it
so
is.
The Avanti is still here. I haven't given it away, but I am in the process of doing that. So maybe some listener who wants to get an Avanti, mine's a 1981, should contact me. And either I'll loan it or we'll find an exchange and do some bartering so that it can be of use more than just a visual delight to me.
Well, let me know if you have an interest in some roller skates. I've lost the skate key. A book called No Sweat, having to do with lodges. And I'll throw in my personal Lucky Rabbit's Foot. But as far as the Avanti, that's a fascinating story, though. Yes, material things can get in the way of our living a free and released life. This book is titled My Death, a personal guidebook by Jeremy Kagan. Death is not the end of being. Professor Kagan is an award-winning film and television director and producer and a great artist, in addition to writing and sharing this book and this story. Professor, where do we get copies of your book?
Well, anywhere you want online. It's available in every form, certainly from Balboa directly, but you can also get it if you just type in the title on Amazon, so it's there as well. You can get it for your Kindle or for your iPhone or any of those iDevices. And I recommend, actually, you can also download it as a PDF from Balboa, which I would recommend as the best form. It's very inexpensive, purposely, because I want as many people to get to read this memoir, to realize that life is bigger than the death and never ends in the sense of its own awareness and consciousness. So for $3, you can find it in any of those e-formats.
Thank you, Professor, for joining me today. Our guest has been Jeremy Kagan. Jeremy Kagan also has a website, The Near Death and Life of JeremyKagan.com. That's The Near Death and Life of JeremyKagan.com, and Kagan is spelled K-A-G-A-N. Thank you, sir, for joining us on today's program.
You're totally welcome. Thanks, Jay. It was fun. I hope this was of value to people who listen to it.
Thank you so much. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.